According to the ancient Vedic culture of India, reserve and shyness is an essential part of beauty. But so sorry they contribute to that. The sense of beauty about saris is that instead of the lady revealing everything, that the men, they have to imagine, and that makes things even more attractive for them. Nowadays the standard, of course, is the opposite. Reveal everything and there's no mystery. Of course, these days the competition is so intense that I guess the notion is that the more you reveal, the greater your chances are, you know. But that has nothing to do with actual human development. I guess we can discuss that tonight. What is real human development? Before we can talk about any kind of human progress, we have to understand what our purpose in life is. But how can people talk about what is their purpose in life if they don't know what life is? So when you talk about life, what are you talking about? You're talking about some chemicals, or are you talking about something more? Now, we're teaching you from Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. These are the prime Vedic texts that all spiritual culture in India is based upon. And now that culture has spread around the world in the form of Krishna consciousness. You might wonder, when did Krishna consciousness begin? But it's not possible to trace out the beginning. What is life? You're all living, but what is it that makes a living person? Have you ever wondered about that? What makes a living person? I was talking Friday with one, I guess, 16-year-old young man in Auckland. He had just finished his exams for the sixth form. So I asked him, what are you studying for? And he said, well, I want to go to the university. No one will have any complaints about that, right? He's studying because he wants to go to university. And I said, well, why will you study at the university? What's the purpose? He said, well, to get a job. So I said, well, what's the reason why you want a job? And he said, well, you know, to support my life. So then I said, well, what is life? He said, well, life means be what you want to be and do what you want to do. So I said, that's the only definition of life you can give me? That's your purpose? That's life? He said, yes, that's what it's all about. And then one older man there, about your age, he added a qualifier, like a subheading. He said that in addition to being what you want to be and doing what you want to do, also as a minor point, you should always consider others while you're being what you want to be and doing what you want to do. So most people would think this is a very fair statement, yes? Be what you want to be, do what you want to do. You like that? To an extent. Why not fully?
A bit more than that.
Like what, for example? This is your friend here? Okay, so... Sure. Lightens things up. Do you tell him sometimes? What's his name?
Michael.
Michael, I want to be what I want to be and do what I want to do. But there's a bit more to that. So what would you say then, Michael?
Yeah, I agree with that. You should do what you want to do within reason.
Within reason. We get all these special clauses here, within reason.
Okay, you should just do what you want to do.
As long as it doesn't hurt others. Now, how do we know whether we're hurting others or not? So you always, he's always aware that, for example, he might hurt you. He's always aware. Right? No comment. Uh-oh. You know, it's normal, you know. It doesn't imply any diminishment of your glory. It's just normal in interactions. We hurt people without knowing it. Right? So.
But isn't that different from basically saying that you hurt someone without knowing?
He's asking, isn't that different from purposely setting out to hurt someone? Any other comments on that? What would you say?
I'd say that we know what hurts other people because we know what hurts ourselves.
So if it doesn't hurt you, then it doesn't hurt others.
And that's the only way that I can know what hurts others.
I see. Does everyone agree with that? The only way you can know what hurts others is if is first you think, does it hurt me?
You're right, that's not always. Sometimes you can hurt another person while you're not aware.
Ah, yes, you can hurt another person while you're not aware. But I like Michael's point here that you might hurt someone intentionally. He might hurt you unintentionally, but that's far different from purposely setting out to hurt someone. Now, I'd like to expand this topic by bringing up the Vedic concept of nonviolence, which in Sanskrit is known as ahimsa. I think some of you probably have heard of that word before, ahimsa. Generally, we take ahimsa, or nonviolence, to mean that you don't physically hurt anyone. The Buddhists have a particular understanding of this word. But actually, from the Vedic perspective in Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, it's a very limited understanding, if you don't mind me saying. Nonviolence, as ordinarily known, means that you don't hurt other humans. Even for your political purposes, you want to correct some governmental wrongs, so you have nonviolent demonstrations. And then, more broad than that is the Buddhist definition of ahimsa. Nonviolence means you don't hurt any living entities, even if they're not human. So for a more expanded version of nonviolence, you wouldn't, kill animals or eat of their flesh. But the Vedic definition of nonviolence is even greater. When we hear from Krishna in Bhagavad Gita, we learn that ahimsa, nonviolence, means to never act in a way that hinders someone's spiritual development. In other words, when we talk about violence, we have to understand what's the most important part of our existence. Is it the body or is it something else? So I may be very sensitive towards your body. Just like whenever you go somewhere, when you first show up at work, everyone says, oh, how you doing today? How you doing? And of course you give the mechanical response, yeah, all right, fine, okay. Rarely do you say, horrible. Sometimes maybe, I know ladies may say that, men never say that. Ladies, they can be more communicative, but men, when they have a problem, they just kind of keep it to themselves until they go to the pub and then they drink with the boys and then they start talking about it. But ladies, generally, as soon as there's a problem, they go on the phone to another lady. Oh, guess what happened to me? No! Not to say I'm not making any value difference. I'm just saying there is a difference. Yes. So, generally the men are the last to figure it out, though. There's a difference. So they always get confused. Why are you so angry at me? Or what's wrong? What have I done wrong? And the ladies are, you don't understand. That makes it even worse. Yes, is that the way it goes? I learn all this by observing. So, it's one thing to be concerned about someone's physical and mental well-being. But it's another thing to be concerned about their spiritual well-being. So for the full definition of nonviolence, we have to understand our spiritual identity. And then we can understand that to hinder someone's spiritual development, that's the greatest violence. To treat someone in such a way that their spiritual advancement is not honored, this is the greatest violence. Now, we all can appreciate violence to the body. Oh, we don't want that. You're walking around a lonely street in Wellington at night and you're fearful of your body. Or if you're, perhaps, if you turn on the television, you're fearful of your mind. But the real fear should be, what about my spiritual development? In other words, I'm more than just the body and mind. I have an eternal identity. What's happened to that? I'm spirit soul lost in an ocean of matter. So I need persons around me who will help me or who will inspire me to revive my spiritual identity. In fact, I should be a member of a society that has such a purpose as its primary goal. Now, how many of you feel that you're surrounded by a few friends, family, and society that's urging you, you must solve your spiritual quest? Anyone? What did you say in the back? What's your name, I'm sorry? Michael? Another Michael. So, would you say that your friends and family and your society, they're urging you, stimulating you to solve the ultimate issues of life? Yeah. Anyone? What about you? Oh, but your husband is interested in that. Yeah. Okay, so there's one. And your children there. Yes, you back there. They listen so nicely. So, this is the major problem we have today, and therefore, from the viewpoint of Bhagavad Gita, we live in a very violent world. The world is not a violent place just because, for example, the USA is about to bomb Iraq again. The world is not a violent place because Hurricane Mitch wiped out 11,000 people in Central America last week or the week before. The world is mostly a violent place, according to the Vedic standard, because it is hostile for spiritual development. Now, who here would dare think that they act in a way that's hostile for someone's spiritual development? You would never think that, right? You would never think that, right? Yeah, you would never do anything to jeopardize someone's spiritual development. You would never think that, right? Anyone? You'd never think that, right? No, everyone thinks, well, I'm a good person. Especially here in New Zealand, everyone knows how to tolerate everybody's individual trip. I've noticed that's a cardinal law here, that everyone is allowed to have their own private batch in their mind. You don't disturb, everyone's private batch in the mind. So, the principle is that each to his own. As long as you don't disturb me, I don't disturb you. And in that way, we hope there'll be peace. So certainly, we can't imagine, how could I be violent towards someone? How could I disturb someone's spiritual advancement? Now, if we study Bhagavad Gita, we'll find out the first way we commit spiritual violence is by treating someone like they're the body. Mm. Mm. Now, have we been guilty of that? Treating someone like they're the body? Now, you say, but anyway, I never do that, so what? Oh, but just out of curiosity, what does it mean? It's already established I don't do it, so what does it mean to treat someone like they're the body? Whatever it is, it sounds like something I don't do, but anyway, what is it? To treat someone as if they're the body means just that. It means to take their material coverings as the all-in-all and not treat them as their spirit soul. That means you consider their bodily needs and you ignore their spiritual needs. It's like having a bird in a cage. Anyone have a pet bird here? No. You do back there?
Yeah,
cockatoo. Oh, you've got a
fly out around.
It's in a cage?
Yeah.
Okay, who feeds the bird? The whole family feeds the bird. All right. Now, suppose you just wanted to take care of the bird by polishing the cage, and that's all you did for the bird. What would happen?
It would die.
Similarly, if you just think, I'm taking care of me, or I'm taking care of another person by simply taking care of the body, that's just as bad, as ridiculous as thinking I'm taking care of the bird by just polishing the cage. The body is like a cage. In the body dwells the spirit soul. This is lesson number one in Bhagavad Gita. Now, we might have thought we heard this before. Yeah, yeah, we all know we're spiritual. We all know that there's something more to us than the body. But what about the full implications of that understanding? That's what separates the smart from the not-so-smart. What are the full implications of not being the body? Suppose, all right, just giving an example from the ordinary bodily conception of life, which plagues everyone. Suppose you thought that helping me would be just to pay attention to my cloth I'm wearing and forgetting what are my actual needs, even from the bodily point of view. Let's say you're drowning and I row out very quickly to save you, and I pull off your jacket and bring it back to shore and announce to everyone, I saved the person, I saved the person. Meanwhile, you're going down. You drown. How would you feel? Obviously, I've missed the point. Similarly, if we just treat people like they're the bodies, we've missed the point. But the whole society today is geared simply on treating people like they're the body. So we may feel, I think I've heard this before. Come on, we're more advanced than that. We know we're spiritual beings. We know we're spiritual people. But let's look at the way we live, and there we'll see that bodily conception looming enormously in our life. The whole society is pounding you. What are you going to do about your body? How are you going to satisfy your body? How are you going to satisfy someone else's body? Everyone is absorbed in feeding themselves, nice sleeping arrangements, nice mating arrangements, and they want to protect their body from attacks, whether attacked by disease or attacked by criminals or whatever. That's it. And if a society can seem to satisfy those four bodily needs of eating, sleeping, mating, and defense, then you think, oh, we live in such a nice society. Now, actually, of course, materialistic societies can't even do those things. But actually, even if materialistic societies could do those things, still you don't have a human society from the Vedic point of view. From the Vedic point of view, a human society is one that allows for spiritual development in full spiritual knowledge. In a real human society, that is the purpose of individual life, it's the purpose of family life, it's the purpose of social life, societal life. Now let's analyze our relationships and see who is helping me to revive my spiritual identity and who is simply concerned with my body. Then things become quite clear. Think of your loved ones, think of your family, your friends, your society. Who is directly stimulating my spiritual development. Now, I'm sure everybody here has dear ones. Now, when's the last time one of your dear ones came up to you and said, you know, I'm really concerned that you don't know why you have this body presently, and you don't know what your future body will be. I'm really concerned about that. How many of you had someone say that? Anyone? No? Your husband hasn't said that to you? You know, we've been married a long time, and I've been meaning to tell you something. I'm concerned that you don't know where you got this present body from, and you're not aware of what your next body will be. And without knowing that, what kind of life is this?
You don't need to know.
Huh?
You don't need to know.
Oh, you don't need to know? Why not?
Why should you? You don't need to know.
But at least you should know what you are. She says you don't need to know everything. But the basics you should know. So you would tell him that. You don't need to know, dear. You would say that. He's going to hear all this on the tape. Your wife said you don't need to know. In case you didn't hear, she's in the back. He's going to listen to a tape tomorrow, you see, so I'm just giving him his cues. He doesn't need to know. So what should he know, then? Or what should you know?
How to be happy.
How to be happy. Yes. So, don't mind me saying so, but this is the whole thrust of so-called civilized society today. Figure out how to be happy without knowing what you are. Bound to succeed, right? Guaranteed success. No doubt about it, right? You get it? It's embarrassing, isn't it? So next time someone says to you, I want to make you happy, first ask them, well, who am I? Then let's talk about how I can be happy. But who does that when someone says, I'm going to make you happy? Have you ever done that? Suppose Michael, he might say, I'm going to make you happy. He said, well, okay, great, but first of all, who am I? Now, generally when someone says, I'm going to make you happy, you say, oh, wonderful, hey, whatever you want to do, go do it. I want to be happy. Everybody wants to be happy, of course. Yeah, we all know what happiness is, don't we? Who here thinks they know what happiness is? Yes? Can you say? Yes.
You can't make generalizations of happiness. It's different things to different people.
Okay. Sure, we won't generalize, so... What would you say is happiness?
You have to have a balance. You can be extremely spiritual and still be happy.
Okay. It's getting interesting now. You can be extremely spiritual and still not happy. Can you explain what it means to be extremely spiritual? Maybe we first better start with what does it mean to be spiritual, then we'll get to extremely spiritual. Over the top spiritual. Okay. Okay. First of all, what does it mean to be spiritual, Michael?
Okay, well, do you live a spiritual life? Do you feel like you live a spiritual
life? No, you're using the word.
No.
you tell me, what does it mean to be spiritual?
Okay, to have a sense of what's more than the materialistic world. Have a sense of...
Okay, can we take one at a time? Is that okay?
Yep, sure.
Okay, to have a sense of more than the materialistic world. Now, what is the materialistic world?
It's the world in which we all live.
Yeah, but what characterizes it?
Having to go to work every day, having to earn money to survive, having to do things that maybe you don't want to do.
So that makes it a materialistic world. Having to go to work every day, having to get money to survive, having to do things you don't want to do. Boom, then you've got materialism, right? No. So someone can't be spiritual by going to work every day and earning money and doing things they don't want to do. For example, I'm not saying I'm spiritual, but if I'm driving on Torrey Street and I get to the corner here of Courtenay Place and there's a red light and I don't feel like stopping, but I stop anyway, I do it even though I don't want to do it. That means I'm not being spiritual, even if I was.
Does that make you spiritual? Stop for a red light?
Well, because part of materialism, as you said, is to you're forced to do what you don't want to do.
I guess that could be part of spirituality as well.
So, probably then, briefly, we need a good definition of materialism. According to Bhagavad Gita, materialism just doesn't mean someone who has more money than you. It means whoever thinks I'm this body, whether you're rich or you're poor, if you think you're the body, then you're a materialist. Matter. You think I am matter.
But you are matter. Surely there has to be a balance between materialism and spiritualism. You can't go either way. Otherwise you're imbalanced and it won't work.
Okay.
I mean, we live in the world, we are of the world, and we have to.
And who is we?
All of us.
So, okay, let's start with you. So we can make the balance. Everyone's into balance, everyone agrees imbalances aren't correct. Now, what... You say that we should balance the spiritual and the material. Now, I've explained from the standard of Bhagavad Gita that a materialist is one who thinks I am matter. Now, how do you balance that? It's wrong. The body, as Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita, the body is a covering. It's like a garment. That's like saying, I'm my shirt. I should say to you, is that navy blue? Hey, navy blue, you ought to get balanced. That's pretty ridiculous, isn't it? You say, hey, that's my shirt, mate. It's not me. No, you're navy blue. You need to be balanced. Maybe you should have some orange shorts on. Balance it out. But you get the point, though. If you think you're matter, that fundamental mistake is impossible to balance. Just like if you think you are the shirt, that's impossible to balance. It's madness. But, you see, in the kind of society we live in, it's not considered madness. It's considered, yeah, sure. You go to the University of Victoria and say, I am matter, and 99% of the professors, very good, you've managed to stay away from any kind of spiritual delusions. You see, for a scientist to be called a materialist, they like that, because they don't take materialists to mean greed or someone who has too much money. We know the definition of someone who has too much money. It means anyone who has more than me. So, they've got to be a materialist. So, a scientist will accept that a materialist means you understand the truth, that there's nothing but matter, and you're free from delusions of spirituality. So, how do you balance that? How do you balance thinking you're not, thinking you're something you're not? Just like I said, it's madness for you to think you're the shirt. Now, if you go around and say, I am navy blue, or I am saffron, how do you balance that? It's like, you know, making a mathematical equation, and in the beginning you say 1 plus 1 equals 3. From that point on, all your calculations are wrong. How do you balance something with 1 plus 1 equals 3? So, this is a very important point. If you think you are matter, then you've missed the whole point completely. And I always bring this example up again and again and again. If you think you are matter, then why should anything matter? You're just a bunch of chemicals. So why worry? She's a bunch of chemicals with a sari on, which is more chemicals. So why worry?
What is it then, if you're not matter?
Yeah.
But hang on, if you're not matter, then okay, then you're completely spiritual. So why worry about that anyway? Everything's kind of supposed to have that, you shouldn't have to.
But that's true, if we understand it. But our problem is we don't understand that we are completely spiritual.
But
there is the rub.
Huh? Why worry about understanding that? Why should it be spiritual?
Because as long as you identify with the material body, you're also identifying with material happiness and distress, which is artificial. It's like when you dream at night. You could be, in your dream, you could be swallowed by a tiger. And as long as you think it's for real, you're terrified. But someone watching you have a nightmare, they know it's just a dream. And then they wake you up, it's just a dream, it's all right. Oh, it's just a dream. Or you could be, you know, embracing a beautiful movie star and think, oh, this is so nice, oh, this magic moment. And then someone wakes you up, oh, it's just a dream. Where is she? So, because we misidentify with the material body, we set ourselves up for all kinds of illusory experiences. Now, if indeed we understand we're non-material, then indeed there's no problem for us. But our problem is we identify with the body. So the first step in Bhagavad Gita is to teach you you're not the body. Without that, according to the Vedic standard, there's no human civilization. And once again, we get back to ahimsa, nonviolence. The full definition of nonviolence is to treat someone in such a way that hinders their spiritual development. To treat someone as if they're the body. Therefore, at almost 100%, we'll just be modest and we'll say almost 100% of what people call love is simply the bodily conception of life. It's hard to find real love because it's all based on the body. What's the example of that? A common sense example. We say so many times this example. It's amazing. We've all, those our staff here, some of us have heard this example for 25 years. But still, these things never fail to produce proper reflection. According to the Vedic standard, repetition of a good thing, that is a virtue. So, let's say, oh, I forgot your name. What is it again?
Madhuri.
Madhuri has met an untimely end. So, you've been asked to go down to the morgue to identify her. So there, Madhuri, she's laying out cold slab. Now, why don't you take her home? Why not? There she is.
Because she's not there anymore. She can't converse. She can't.
What's missing? The body is there. She could be wearing the same sari she's wearing now. It's all there. All the essential features. Why aren't you interested? Something else. So that means, now what is that something else?
Well, of course it's the soul.
Of course it's the soul. All right. The soul, yes, Bhagavad Gita would agree with you. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita that within the body there is the soul, and the soul moves from one body to another. Now, you're saying she's gone. The soul is gone. Now, that means the real Madhuri you never saw.
No, that's untrue because you see this gold in the person.
Really? Where do you see it? Through her ears or her eyes or what does it look like?
When she expresses herself better.
What do you see? Some bright lights flashing or tell me what the soul looks like when she expresses herself.
No one knows what the soul looks like. It's just a manifestation of the soul.
That means then you don't know her real beauty, right?
But do you know anyone's real beauty?
If you think the person is a body, no.
But that doesn't stop you from appreciating the body.
That's right. That's right. And that may be the problem. Well, just because I don't know who you really are doesn't stop me from appreciating. Now you understand society's problem. We don't know who we are, but don't make that into a problem. I don't know who you are, you don't know who I am, but let's not have that be a barrier, you know? Life has to go on. This is what everyone says. look, you may have time to think of these ultimate issues, but we practical people, we have to, you know, put food on the table, we have to pay the rent, you know? We have drives we have to take care of. In our leisure moments, maybe we can discuss these issues that you've raised, but look, we're in the real world. We people who don't know who we are, we're in the real world. And you guys who think about this, these kind of issues all the time, well, you know, you're just a fringe section of society. But sooner or later, you're going to have to get real. Once again, I say, this shows you don't have human society. The soul, we don't know. Bhagavad Gita purports to teach you the process for reviving your spiritual identity. You've never lost it, but you've forgotten. How to act as a spirit soul. Did you ever tell him that, Madhuri? Well, I know, Michael, that you understand I'm soul, but what does that mean, you know? How do you treat a soul? What would you say? Well, Madhuri, look, you know, as long as the body's there, it's not really a problem. Well, that's what everybody says. Right? Isn't that what everybody says?
Yes.
This shows we have a basic ignorance of how to live spiritually. We don't know the science of the soul. We don't know how to live as soul. We think that without the body, there's no life. That's like a drunkard thinking, without alcohol, I can't live. Well, you know, yeah, we're the soul, but how do you live without a body? How do you have pleasure without a body? So you have to have a balance. You have to be the body, even though you're not, you see? You understand, right? You have to be the body, even though you're not, because otherwise you can't have any fun. Therefore, for real fun, there has to be this balance. You've got to be who you are and who you're not at the same time. It all adds up to a balance, you see? Makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? No, it doesn't. So, in a real human civilization, the people are trained and educated in spiritual activities. Now, what are spiritual activities? That would be the subject of Chapter 9 of Bhagavad Gita, which is called the Most Confidential Knowledge. I'll just read that to you. I was about to discuss happiness, but now things have taken an exciting turn. What would you like to hear about happiness? We'll just give you a brief discussion about happiness. Bhagavad Gita divides everything in the material world into three categories: goodness, passion, and ignorance. Okay, now Krishna is speaking. Please hear from me about the three kinds of happiness by which the conditioned soul, that means a soul in illusion who identifies with the body, by which the conditioned soul enjoys and by which he sometimes comes to the end of all distress. So I'll read you the purport of this verse. A conditioned soul tries to enjoy material happiness again and again. Thus he chews the chewed. Have any of you ever done that? Chewed the chewed? You can imagine what it's like. You can try it tonight at dinner. You can take some of the very nice food stuff we serve and chew it thoroughly. Proper term for it, masticate it thoroughly. Get all the molars into it and just tear it to shreds and grind all the juice out. And then you take it and you hand it to your partner and say, please enjoy. No one would do that. You wouldn't do that to your brother, would you? Why? Yeah, it's not a good thing to do, to chew the food completely and then hand it to someone and say, isn't this nice? So, material life is like that. No one's ever gotten any juice out, but generation after generation passes down things that have already been chewed completely. And so each generation of family does that. The parents say to the children, I've chewed and now I'm passing it to you. How many parents tell their children, I chewed and chewed, there's no taste there, don't make the same mistake. No, every parent hopes that even though I failed in chewing, please, you go on and chew the same thing. They all have this hope that although our generation failed, maybe your generation will find the nectar that we missed. So in this way, generation after generation tries the same mistake, and they die fatigued. All right. So, a conditioned soul tries to enjoy material happiness again and again. Thus he chews the chewed. But sometimes, in the course of such enjoyment, he becomes relieved from material entanglement by association with a great soul. How many of you feel like you're in material entanglement? You know? Do you feel like you're in material entanglement? Yeah? Do you and your husband feel like you're in material entanglement? Parfait. Okay. And? I'm sorry, what's your name?
Denise.
Denise.
I'm getting right into it, actually.
Okay. Do you feel like you're in material entanglement? Okay. Okay. So, in other words, a conditioned soul is always engaged in some type of sense gratification. But when he understands by good association that it is only a repetition of the same thing, and he is awakened to his real Krishna consciousness, he is sometimes relieved from such repetitive so-called happiness. All right. Now we'll start with the description of the three types of happiness in the material world. We're not talking about spiritual happiness, by the way. We're talking about happiness on the material plane. So this should be very familiar to all of us, because we've all endeavored in that way. Even a child has endeavored or is endeavoring for material happiness. Right? He wants to be happy with things made of matter. That's what it... Yes? He's got his toy there that's made of matter. He wants to have happy emotions. The emotions are made of subtle matter. The Vedic standard will teach you that. He wants a warm hug from his mom, right? So. Okay. Happiness in the mode of goodness. This is the highest type of happiness in the material world. Still in the material world, though, but it's the highest level of happiness possible in the material world. That which in the beginning may be just like poison, but at the end is just like nectar, and which awakens one to self-realization is said to be happiness in the mode of goodness. So remember that key phrase. In the beginning it seems to be like poison, in the end it's like nectar. So what could be like that? Any of you know anything that could be in this category? Seems to be like poison in the beginning, but in the end it's like nectar, and it awakens one to self-realization. Alright, I'll read the purport. In the pursuit of self-realization, one has to follow many rules and regulations to control the mind and the senses, and to concentrate the mind on the self. All these procedures are very difficult, bitter like poison, but if one is successful in following the regulations and comes to the transcendental position, he begins to drink real nectar and he enjoys life. Okay, we'll get to that. But first, try to understand this highest level of happiness in the material world. To be good in this material world means to control your senses. This definition of goodness is lost today. To control your senses may seem difficult, just like this child. He may want to do whatever he wants to do, but his mother says, no, you have to learn to act this way and not that way. He may just want to race out into the middle of traffic, and his mother will say, you've got to learn when to cross the street. Now, he may be angry. I just want to race off into traffic. He may say that. But his mother says, no, I will not let you go outside until you learn how to cross the street properly. Especially if you live in the center of Wellington. You'd be very concerned with your child's safety. You have to learn how to cross at the light. So that might be bitter for him in the beginning. But it's for his own good. Similarly, the rules and regulations of spiritual development may seem bitter, but then we realize it's for my ultimate happiness. Okay, the next level is called mode of passion. This is more familiar these days. That happiness which is derived from the contact of the senses with their objects, and which appears like nectar at first, but poison at the end, is said to be of the nature of passion. Now, how many of you know material experiences like that, which seem to be like nectar in the beginning, but then turn out to be poison? Any examples of that?
I was invited to go to a place in Winston City to do some artwork, paintings, and pictures. I arrived there, they had everything sold out for me. Everything was perfect, beautiful. Now, I went into another room where I was told to come with a man to have workers on me. I had a little bit, but I said, "That's not fine." And then I was going back. He said, "Oh, what's you mean back?" I said, "Back to the place you had just got me from." "Oh no, you don't do that here." And it's like a completely new world. It's just a change. I don't know why. Something seems to happen when I came into here today.
Okay, but how is that like poison at the end?
Ah.
Yes.
Because poison at the end was, he gave me a place to sit down to do my artwork. Then I discovered it was very, very small space. I couldn't really get my feelings into there.
So you had big expectations, and then it turned out to be
very small.
Yeah. Okay. So let's hear this definition of happiness in the mode of passion again. Derived from contact of the senses with their objects. Everyone knows about that? Contact of the senses with the objects? And which appears like nectar at first, but poison at the end, is said to be of the nature of passion. Okay, we'll read the purport. This is an adult purport here. A young man and a young woman meet, and the senses drive the young man to see her, to touch her, and to have sexual intercourse. In the beginning, this may be very pleasing to the senses, but at the end, or after some time, it becomes just like poison. They are separated, or there is divorce, there is lamentation, there is sorrow, and so forth. Such happiness is always in the mode of passion. Happiness derived from a combination of the senses and the sense objects is always a cause of distress and should be avoided by all means. So no one has any experience of all that. So we'll go on to the next one. Happiness in the mode of ignorance. This is the lowest kind of happiness in the material world. And that happiness which is blind to self-realization, which is delusion from beginning to end, which arises from sleep, laziness, and illusion, is said to be of the nature of ignorance. So here's the difference. There's not even a promise of happiness. It's illusion from beginning to end.
Yeah.
So, one who takes pleasure in laziness and in sleep is certainly in the mode of darkness, ignorance. And one who has no idea how to act and how not to act is also in the mode of ignorance. For the person in the mode of ignorance, everything is illusion. There's no happiness either in the beginning or at the end. For the person in the mode of passion, there might be some kind of ephemeral happiness. Imaginary will-o'-the-wisp happiness in the beginning, and at the end distress. But for the person in the mode of ignorance, there's only distress both in the beginning and the end. So this is material civilization. Our society today is predominantly chasing happiness in passion and ignorance. There's certainly there's no pursuit of happiness in the mode of goodness.
Depends who you are and where you're living, what the situation is.
In all situations, people are almost exclusively, 99.9%, chasing happiness in the mode of ignorance or in the mode of passion. Does anyone disagree? What would you say? Oh, it's not all like that, right?
Sorry, say it again.
Would you disagree that everyone is almost exclusively chasing passion and ignorance, that kind of happiness?
No, I wouldn't disagree.
Oh, okay. Anyone else? That sounds severe, doesn't it? What would you say? If your son came home and said, "Dad, I'm going to have to tell you what's going on in society today. Everyone is simply pursuing happiness in the mode of passion and ignorance." What would you say? "Son, you're right." Or, "Son, I think you're generalizing and there's a lot of goodness going around. You just got to open up your eyes and see it." But if he did, if you can be the first one, you can say it. What would you say?
Everyone
is a big generalization. Everyone is. Everyone meaning
99.9. A very, very high proportion.
Yes. Could you give an example of someone who's not chasing happiness in passion and ignorance? Okay, wait. Okay.
So,
that wasn't part of the program. So, now, I think the way I said the question is better, because rather than say, "Well, they're living spiritually," which gets pretty hazy and vague, we just be more pinpoint that they're trying for happiness in passion and ignorance. You see? That makes things very specific and focused. So do you know anyone who's not trying for happiness in passion and ignorance? That would be a more precise question.
I'm not sure what your question is, because I think that covers that. I think it's from there.
Right. Okay. Do you know anyone who is not trying for passion and ignorance? Could you give the example? Could you describe?
What are you asking to describe the quality
of it? Yeah, what their lifestyle is like. How does a person act who's not trying for happiness and passion and ignorance? Wait, I'm... Sorry, please.
That people live devoting their lives to trying to serve God, to get the ability and knowledge.
So in these persons' lives, you don't see any striving for passion and ignorance?
Not striving, but they're dominant.
I understand. You know I'm trying to pin you down. This is what's good about Bhagavad Gita. It makes things very clear. It brings us out of the kind of smoky realm and puts the cards on the table. Yes, we know people have good intentions, but what's actually happening is simply endeavors for happiness in passion and ignorance, for the most part, or to a lesser part, but still it's there. Now, according to the standard of Bhagavad Gita, that has to go. One at least has to come up to the material level of goodness, which means to undergo discipline for controlling the senses. This is the glory of Bhagavad Gita. Everything is very specific and laid out clearly. Otherwise, if you leave it to us, we'll just be namby-pamby and wishy-washy all our life, you know? So this is the advantage of hearing from Krishna. You get pinpoint precise knowledge. Now, why is there the need for sense control? Why is there the need for this happiness in the mode of goodness, which is like poison in the beginning, but nectar at the end, which awakens one to self-realization? How many of you have been very sick before? Anyone? Yes. Now the doctor, he'll put you under a certain medical treatment. And that may be painful. But you don't protest because you know the purpose of the medical treatment is that you get well. But it's uncomfortable. Similarly, the rules and regulations of spiritual purification may feel uncomfortable, but actually they're meant for our well-being. Human civilization begins with understanding we are in a diseased condition of life. We think we are the body. Our spiritual identity is unknown to us. At most, we think we are spiritual just theoretically, but we always act like I am this body. That's a problem. Therefore, we need medical treatment. We need purification, a process, therapy, so that we stop acting for bodily happiness. And we have to, once again, be reintroduced to what is spiritual happiness. You notice that so many people who talk about being spiritual, they're always pursuing material pleasure. They have no choice. If we're going to be spiritual, we have to know what is spiritual pleasure. Can anyone take a stab at that? What is spiritual pleasure? Denise? Well, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna would agree with you. Krishna says, the great souls, the Mahatmas, Maha means great, Atma means soul, the great souls are always chanting my glories. So from the standard of Bhagavad Gita, your chanting would be in that category. Anyone else have an idea what spiritual pleasure is? Spiritual pleasure is not material. But is that enough to, you can hang your hat on, so to speak? Is that enough to get you through life? Just wait. Yeah? Just, someone asks you, well, what kind of pleasure do you have? Well, not material. That won't be enough. So then, you have to be. Can you be more specific if you choose?
I bet you can enjoy things like the sun coming up every day.
How do you enjoy that? The sun is coming up.
It's nice and warm.
And so, that thrills you through and through. What happens when the sun goes down? Then you're not thrilled through and through anymore.
No.
Ah.
Because the birds stop singing.
Yes, the birds stop singing, the sun goes down. That means there can't be real pleasure in these things because there's a limit. It ends. So spiritual pleasure, the first definition, is a Sanskrit word for spiritual pleasure. You might have heard it before. It's called ananda. The difference between spiritual pleasure and material happiness is that spiritual pleasure has no end. So as soon as it stops, then you know. We got a problem. We got a problem here. I'm dealing with temporary matter. So if we're actually going to have spiritual pleasure, then we are in contact with something that has no end. But what shackles us to material life? Attachment to things that have a beginning and an end. Just like this body has a beginning and an end, and we're attached to it. That ruins our pleasure. But just like you were saying, the real Madhuri, you didn't see. She's at the morgue, the body is anyway, and she's gone. The part of her that has no end, what is the process for getting in touch with that? That is the most essential pursuit in life. How to be in touch with the soul and the supreme soul. Simply to understand we are spirit soul, that's the beginning of real life. But then the next question must be solved. What is my relationship with the supreme soul? I'm not the supreme, I'm just a part. So what's the nature of what I am part of? It is here that we need advanced transcendental knowledge. And that is what Krishna consciousness is based on. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains what is the individual soul, what is the supreme soul, what is the relationship between the two. Without that kind of knowledge, we're getting nowhere in our spiritual development. It all becomes theoretical. I'm sure you've all met so many persons who go around saying how they're spiritual. Yeah, I'm into spiritual things. Are you into spirituality? Yeah, I'm into spirituality. And then they just end up doing what everybody else does. You know, you talk spirituality at the cafe, and then you, you know, go on your way to it, you know. So, we need an action plan. That's why Bhagavad Gita is spoken on a battlefield, the most active place you can conceive of. There's no time for theory there. You need an action plan. So in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna speaks on a battlefield the specifics of how to be spiritual even within the material world, even from within the material body. It's not that Krishna has a material body, however. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains that matter and spirit are his energies. So even when Krishna comes to this world, he does not take on a material body. He appears in his original spiritual form. And in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna complains a bit. When I come to this world, fools think I have a body of matter. And you say, well, how can you have a body if it's not made of matter? That means we need spiritual education to introduce us to spiritual form, spiritual activities, spiritual qualities. Because in the material world, all we are aware of is material form, material qualities, material activities. Therefore, some of us think the perfection of spiritual life, we speculate, must be just to annihilate everything material and then we disappear, or then we become the everything, or it gets pretty hazy. But in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna teaches you that once you annihilate your material identity, then you should become aware of your spiritual identity. Simply annihilating your material ego is not the ultimate. Just like nirvana. Everyone's heard the word nirvana. It's a Sanskrit word. Nir means out of, vana means forest. Okay, so Buddha came to teach nirvana. Okay, when you're out of the forest of illusion, though, where are you? Ah, that's the secret. Just like your child, if you tell him, he's sitting behind you. Don't run around, just sit still. Don't do any mischief. Does your mother ever tell you that? He's not saying. Don't run around, don't do mischief, just sit tight. Okay, that'll stop him from getting into trouble. But what is it that he really should do? Sooner or later, he's going to have to know that. He's not going to just be able to sit in the corner forever. So, nirvana means you're out of the forest of illusion. But once you're out of illusion, what now? If you don't know the answer to that question, you'll go back into illusion again. So therefore, from the standpoint of Bhagavad Gita, Buddha taught a very narrow, focused gospel. But there's much more beyond that. What are the activities of the spirit soul in perfection? That's what we should be concerned with. That is real spirituality. Without that kind of knowledge, we're forced to act like we're the body and enjoying that way, even while talking about spirituality.
Give me some knowledge, please.
I am. So, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna tells you, the most confidential knowledge is to understand the activities of the spirit, soul, and perfection. Once you attain enlightenment, it's not that you have no form, no activities, no qualities. No. Enlightenment means perfect spiritual form qualities and activities. But because we have no knowledge of spiritual form qualities and activities, we can't give up the temporary form, this body. We can't give up our temporary activities or qualities. We're attached. This is the problem. Unless you understand the superior, you won't give up the inferior. So this is why everyone talks about spirituality, spiritual, living spiritual, and they do the same thing as everyone else, because there's no knowledge or experience of spiritual perfection. What do you do? What's it like? I don't know. Well, then I might as well just kind of act like everybody else while, you know, talking about being spiritual, reading the latest spiritual books. So this is what separates Krishna consciousness from other things. All right, any final questions? It's been an interesting discussion. What do you think, Madhuri? Stimulating? Michael, what do you think? Any questions?
But you're going to go into happiness a little bit. Can
you? Oh, I talked about material happiness, yes. But you want to know beyond that. Spiritual happiness is contained in the relationship between the individual soul and the Supreme Soul, Krishna. You see, our pursuit of happiness in relationships in this world does indicate that real pleasure can be had, but not in the way we're looking. We're struggling trying to grasp the shadow. It's like I'm making a shadow here. And if you try to grab my hand by grabbing the shadow, you've missed the point. But the shadow there does indicate there's a hand here. Similarly, pursuit of relationships in this world, pursuit of bodily relationships, does give you a hint that there is real happiness based on spiritual form and spiritual activities, based on spiritual relationship. But we don't know how to have a spiritual relationship. I always say this, but 99.9% of people I talk to, especially couples, they always say, well, I'm different. My girlfriend, she's spiritual. They all say that. Yeah, but we're different, you know. We have a spiritual relationship. Everybody says it. It's a real good excuse these days. Yeah, but you know, he's spiritual. Oh, yeah. Okay. So, we need real education about spiritual relationship. That is between the individual soul and the Supreme Soul. By learning the art, science, and culture of loving Krishna, then you know how to love everyone, because everyone is part of Krishna. But to try to love everyone individually is impossible. Have you ever tried to love everybody individually? No. Typically just so-called loving one person. But if you learn the art, science, and culture of loving Krishna, because Krishna contains everyone, then you can love everyone. Water the tree at the root, and all the branches blossom. That's better than trying to water each flower individually. So happiness is contained in the relationship between the individual soul and the Supreme Soul, between the living entity and Krishna. But we've forgotten Krishna, this source of matter and spirit. We want to live in this world as if we exist on our own and the world exists on our own. And then we want to be happy.
Well, get me happy, take me to Krishna.
Yes. Come to the right place. So, any other questions?
Yeah, I have a question.
Okay.
Can you describe what is unified spiritual consciousness would be like?
Can I describe?
Unified spiritual consciousness
yes.
would be like.
Yes. That means you understand you are eternally the servant of Krishna. The whole point of Bhagavad Gita is that Arjuna didn't want to carry out Krishna's order. But at the end of Bhagavad Gita, after listening to Krishna, he said, my illusion's now gone, I will act according to what you say. That is unity. Just like, let's give a material example. In a family, ideally in a traditional family, which don't exist too much anymore, the children are supposed to obey the parent. Still go on like that in your family? Or? Oh, they go to a Steiner school, huh? So they can...
No, they go to Montessori.
Oh, Montessori, yes. So that means they can...
They have their own... they have charge of their own...
Okay. But at some point in your home, you do ask for obedience, right?
Yeah,
they charge. So, unity in the home then means when the children and the parents are united for the same purpose. Unity does not mean the children, they lose their identity and they merge with the parents. So Bhagavad Gita will teach you that the highest understanding of unity is that the individual soul harmonizes with the Supreme Soul. It's not that the individual soul loses the identity, loses the individuality. No. In the second chapter of the Gita, Krishna says, never was there a time when you were not an individual. Never will there be such a time. So right in the beginning of Bhagavad Gita, the eternality of individuality is established. But not material individuality. See, Bhagavad Gita distinguishes between false ego and real ego. So Krishna will instruct you to annihilate the false ego. But your real ego, that's spiritual. Real ego means I am the servant of Krishna. So in that relationship of servitorship to the Supreme Lord, there is perpetual happiness. I see, I got to it. That's a nice question. Any more?
What is the definition of the enlightenment?
Enlightenment begins with understanding I'm not the body. I am spirit soul. Then, higher than that is to understand what the duties of the spirit soul are in perfection. What are the activities? So the different levels of enlightenment. But we have it tough in society today because people don't even have the beginning level of enlightenment. They don't understand what they are. But still they want to be happy. They want to love, help, be happy. They have no idea what they are.
I got enlightened first, personally, by having marijuana.
No. We don't accept that. And that would Krishna in Bhagavad Gita would consider that happiness in the mode of ignorance.
Good, good. That got me from ignorance to even understand what the heck is Krishna.
Without, as long as you're using drugs, there's no question of any enlightenment. Things become darker. That's why they call it dope.
Yeah.
It dopes you up. Right. Now we're already illusioned when we're born, thinking I'm the body. Then you take more dope and you become more of a dope. So, in Krishna consciousness, we have strict rules. No intoxication. Not even caffeine.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. We're already illusioned enough. We don't need to complicate it. Yeah. Any other questions? You back? Everything sounded okay, or there were some points that... Wait. Okay. We can talk more later. Any points that were a bit tough for you? Or?
A few, yeah.
Well, we can talk about it now or later as you like. Or you just want to think about it. Whatever. All right. Thank you all for participating in our discussion so nicely. See, by me asking questions, I get to learn also, you see? It's a two-way street, you know? So you've contributed to my understanding of how human beings are thinking, and I'm trying to impart some understanding of how the source of all the human beings is thinking, how Krishna, what is Krishna saying? So now we'll have a little chanting. you all know, I think, the Hare Krishna mantra. Even if you don't know what it's all about, simply by chanting, you'll find the atmosphere become mysteriously blissful.